For that reason, I'll be very succinct in my introductions. We're now on to the session of European Arrangements Old and New, the UK and Italy, which I find a fascinating subject. And our first presenter is Dr. Meg Russell. She is a Senior Research Fellow with the University College London, and she has done a major project on the comparative study of second chambers to inform the second stage of the House of Lords reform, which I find a fascinating thing to have spent some time doing. That's just a small slice of the work that she has conducted during her career. So, Dr. Russell.
Hello. Well, I was a little alarmed when I saw the name of this section of the programme, Bicameralism in Europe, Old and New, Britain and Italy. Let me put my thing up, actually, I forgot this. I think that probably makes me old and him new. And as some of you will know, because I've presented in Australia before and at other conferences some of you have been to, I've made it my work for the last few years to go around saying, actually, the House of Lords is not old. The House of Lords is actually rather modern and new and exciting. So here I find myself doing old. So what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about old and then a bit more about new in terms of the House of Lords and what all of that could teach us for bicameralism, particularly for Australia. One reason that I thought I would for once mention the old is that actually there is no avoiding the fact that in one sense the House of Lords really is pretty old. This is a quote from a book in the 1950s. It would be true to say that William the Conqueror founded the House of It would be half true to say that William the Conqueror founded the House of Lords. Only half true, because what William founded was not wholly new, but was at least partly based on the old Saxon, I call it Witan, I'm never sure how to pronounce that, the meeting of wise men, which was already some four centuries old at the conquest of 1066. So I think by anybody's standards, that is pretty old. There are some slides on your handout about the old House of Lords, which I'm just going to skip in order to get to the new stuff, which interests me more. But you can go back and read them afterwards if you would like. But I'll say a few words about the conventional view of the old House of Lords. And I'm grateful to Tony Mugan for reinforcing some of these stereotypes in what he said this morning. Everybody tends to do so. The conventional view of the old House of Lords is it's a very ancient parliamentary institution. It was a hereditary institution where seats were handed down through generations of families, through the nobility. It was a conservative chamber. And in placing it in terms of what form of bicameralism, it was an elite chamber. In a class-based system of mixed government, where the upper house represented the upper classes and the House of Commons represented more of the common people. In fact, and if you look back on the slides which I'm skipping, which are on the handout, you'll get some of the background on this. In some ways, the old House of Lords is not actually what it seems. This is a picture here of the chamber of the House of Lords, which looks like a beautiful old place. And indeed, it is a beautiful old place, but the chamber of the House of Lords actually dates to 1847. It's a neo-Gothic institution, not a real Gothic institution. And in some ways, the image that we have of the House of Lords is this kind of neo-Victorian image rather than the real thousand-year-old image or from times in between. If you look back over the House of Lords' long history, in fact, it wasn't always a hereditary house. Titles which members of the House used to hold represented position and were not necessarily handed down through families. As recently as the 16th and 17th century, it was the case that titles were not necessarily hereditary. The House also was not always conservative. It was part of the 17th century Whig oligarchy, for example. In fact, The house that we have now is an appointed house, as I'll come on to say, but the dynamic of the House of Lords back over a long period has always been significantly influenced by new appointments, by the ability of the king or the monarch and subsequently prime ministers to put new people into the house. And there have been occasions in history going back 300 plus years when new appointees have been put in the house in order to make life easier for the executive, people who are sympathetic to the executive. At the end of the 18th century, when it had been a Whig institution, William Pitt the Younger put in 90 new peers over a space of less than 20 years. So the hereditary house is a little bit of a myth. The power of the chamber fluctuated over time, depending on the circumstances in which it found itself and its balance, of course, and its power was often controversial over time. When you think about it, the idea that the House of Lords is a kind of perfect example of mixed class-based government, at best, it was a post hoc rationalisation because that wasn't the case at the outset. And at worst, it was actually untrue because actually, for example, in the 18th century, the House of Lords was an elite institution, but the House of Commons was a pretty much equally elite institution. The House of Commons wasn't really a representative of the common people, and it took the Reform Acts through the 19th century and into the early 20th century to widen the franchise until you could more realistically say that was the case. So the two chambers were not actually as distinct as perhaps we tend to think. A few years ago, I published a book on New Labour, the phenomenon, other famous phenomenon in Britain of New Labour. And there was a section in the closing chapter where I talked about the myth of old Labour and the myth of New Labour. And I think we can say some similar things about the House of Lords. The old House of Lords is a bit of a myth. And it's a creation of those with short memories, really. The old House of Lords, when we think about the old House of Lords, we're thinking about the conservative House of Lords in the 19th and early 20th centuries, really. The House of Lords which tried to block those reform acts which widened the franchise. And, of course, one of the reasons it tried to do that was because members of the House of Lords had significant control over who members of the House of Commons were, and they were going to be losing that control. So to move on to the new House of Lords. This just outlines some of the developments in the 20th century. Some of the key steps to the new House of Lords, and what I'm calling the new House of Lords is the House post-1999. At the beginning of the 20th century, well known, the 1911 Parliament Act introduced limits on the House's powers for the first time. They had been co-equal houses formally. In fact, there were conventions over financial privilege for the House of Commons dating back to the 17th century, but those conventions were put into legislation for the first time by the 1911 Parliament Act, and the House's absolute veto was reduced to a suspensive veto of around 2 years. When the Labour Party was founded, early in the 20th century, it was in favour of the abolition of the House of Lords, but when it formed its first majority government in 1945, it came to realise that the House of Lords, and this is something where I agree with Tony, that the House of Lords was actually quite a useful institution for all the legislative amendment that it did on points of detail. And one of the reasons that the Labour Party, perhaps as in Australia, came to live with the House of Lords was that by the time the Labour Party gained its first majority in 1945, landslide majority, the House of Lords had become a relatively timid institution. It was Conservative-dominated, and it was very nervous to use its powers against a majority Labour government. In fact, during that government, the only thing the House of Lords sought to block was the 1949 Parliament Act, which further limited its powers to a suspensive veto of only 1 year rather than two. The next thing that happened, a key development in the 20th century, was the passage of the Life Peerages Act in 1958, which allowed for the first time, not for the first time in history actually, but for the first time in about 500 years, members to enter the House for life without passing their titles onto their children. And one of the reasons that was passed was simply because of the spiralling size of the House, given that people kept making appointments And the appointments that were made were never going to dissolve unless the lineage died out. So life appointment was quite a practical thing to do to try and keep on top of the size of the house. As well as it was passed by a Conservative government who wanted to ensure that the legitimacy of the house was enhanced and that it could continue to exist rather than being seen as an increasingly anachronistic institution. The 1958 Peerages Act brought women into the chamber for the first time, rather late in terms of parliamentary development. And then the crucial thing, which I've tended to talk about a lot over the last few years, was the reform in 1999, when the Labour government finally removed the vast majority of the remaining hereditary peers, leaving a chamber largely made up of life peers. So the new House of Lords, as I'm calling it, I'll just look at its composition, its policy interventions, and a little bit about bicameral relations. In brief, the composition of the current House of Lords is dominated by life peers, although there are 92 hereditary peers who remain as part of a compromise when that bill was going through. But they're very active members, those remaining hereditaries. We do still have the vestige of the bishops, who I'm not really going to talk about, and don't play a major part in the House. It's a very large House, currently 732 members, and appointments continue apace. It is also a new House in the sense not only that the rules of its composition are different to what they used to be, but that actually of the people sitting in the House now, more than half of them were appointed since Labour came to power in 1997. There is actually quite a lot of turnover in membership of the House. So in terms of faces, it is a substantially new House. One of the key differences between this House and the House which immediately preceded it is that the main parties are now almost exactly equally balanced. Labour and the Conservatives each have around 200 seats. There are then around 200 seats held by independent members, and the rest by the third party, the Liberal Democrats, who are a bit like the Australian Democrats. So neither of the two main parties has a majority, and the third party and independents hold the balance of power. The way that people get in there continues to be by appointment. Party members are chosen by the party leaders, and the independent members are chosen by a new appointments commission, which was established in the year 2000. And the tradition is that these people are drawn from what I've called the great and the good, people who have achieved prominence in their professions. Party members, a lot of former MPs, but others in the parties, and particularly on the independent benches, come from business, the arts, the voluntary sector, the civil service, these kinds of things. The fact that the reform in 1999 ended the Conservative dominance, which had been the case through the 19th and early 20th centuries, and at the same time nearly ended the hereditary membership, has given the chamber substantially more confidence than it had before. I said it was a relatively timid chamber in the mid-20th century. Its confidence to assert itself against the lower house and the executive has been substantially enhanced by the removal of the hereditary peers and the fact that it's now a party-balanced chamber. It's probably feeling more confident than it has for any time over the last 100 years. In terms of policy interventions, given what I've just said, perhaps not surprising that it's having an important policy impact now. Another of the myths, I think, about the House of Lords, and I'll say a bit more about this later, is that its delaying power is minor. Tony said the delaying powers in places like Spain and Ireland are much shorter than the House of Lords. But a delay power of a year, in international terms, is actually quite substantial. It's not an absolute veto, but a year is quite a long time for a government to have to wait. That delay power had not been used for a long time, but now that the chamber is feeling more confident due to its new party balance, it poses a much more significant threat. It's much more sort of in contention that bills will be blocked and government will get in difficulty with the House of Lords. The chamber, since it was reformed in 1999, has actually inflicted over 400 defeats on government legislation. That's not 400 bills, that's amendments to bills and so on, but 400 defeats is quite a long time, and most British people don't even realise that this is going on because the Chamber remains pretty low profile in the media in Britain. I talk to British audiences and say, how many times do you think the House of Lords has defeated the government? If you're talking to school children or something, somebody will say, five? And when you say 400, there's generally a gasp around the room. And although the House of Commons can overturn House of Lords defeats, research that we've done at UCL, at the Constitution Unit, of all of the defeats that have happened over a lengthy period of about 8 years and what happened to them subsequently shows that actually somewhere near half of the time when the House of Lords defeats the government, there is some compromise which results in a significant change to the legislation. The House of Commons doesn't simply overturn House of Lords defeats. They do actually have meaningful results. Some of these, some of the policy changes have been quite visible. This is particularly where, you know, there are major elements of bills which are blocked or even bills blocked altogether. A lot of the interventions which are the most high profile have been on civil liberties matters, things like anti-terrorist legislation, restrictions on trial by jury, the government's attempts to introduce a new offence of incitement to religious hatred. And one of the reasons for this interest in civil liberties is that this is something on which the opposition parties, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives in the House of Lords, can find common ground against the Labour government since 1999, but also something where a lot of the independent members, some of whom are lawyers, many from the voluntary sector, etc., take a serious interest. So the House very much has a profile on those kind of issues. Clearly, defeats are very visible, but I believe that the overall impact of the House of Lords is the defeats are kind of the tip of the iceberg, the visible part above the surface. The overall policy impact of the Lords is much bigger than an analysis of defeats alone suggests. When you talk to members, and I've surveyed members and asked them about this, where do they think the Chamber's biggest policy impact is? They think it is in negotiation behind the scenes and amendments which go on to be accepted on the floor, perhaps reluctantly by government, rather than through defeat. So we know that it's having a big policy impact, bigger than is visible, by sort of easy checking off of how many times the government is defeated. So John wanted us to focus on this idea of bicameral relations, and I've really been talking about the Lords versus the government. What about the relations between the chambers? Harry said yesterday, you can't even really talk about bicameral relations in Australia. But I think in Britain, you can. There are some quite interesting things going on, actually, between the two parliamentary chambers. At the same time as the House of Lords, under the Labour government, has become more assertive, the House of Commons, and particularly Labour members, governing party backbenchers in the House of Commons, have become more rebellious. Academics in Britain have studied over decades how the House of Commons has been becoming more rebellious. But the rebelliousness of government backbenchers got a major boost when Tony Blair came to power with a huge kind of exaggerated House of Commons majority. You could vote against the government without any danger of bringing it down. And so discipline began to break down to some extent on the government backbenchers. So you can talk in Britain about Labour rebels, leading Labour rebels. And when government backbenchers have been unhappy with their Labour government's legislation, they have at times publicly called for the House of Lords to defeat it. We had an example of some controversial health legislation where a former health secretary wrote letters to all the members of the House of Lords saying, we couldn't manage to defeat this in the House of Commons, but you must defeat it. This is somebody from the governing party. And Robin Cook, who got a name check earlier, former Foreign Secretary and leader of the House of Commons, having just rebelled against the government on some anti-terror legislation, a large rebellion in the House of Commons of about 60 members, he went on the television and said, the House of Commons has sent the House of Lords a message. That is, we are signalling to you, we don't really like this, you must defeat it. And the House of Lords undoubtedly hears those messages. Members say that rebellions in the House of Commons are significant in their calculations as to whether they should oppose legislation. So when the government concedes to the demands of the House of Lords, I said it's doing this despite the fact the Lords doesn't have an absolute veto, it's doing this not because the House of Lords has absolute power, but because it wants to avoid risking controversy, issues coming up in the media, affecting public opinion, but also because when the House of Lords introduces a change to legislation, there is a danger, actually, the government could end up getting defeated in the House of Commons over it. And this did happen over the religious hatred legislation that I referred to. The Commons initially passed it, the House of Lords threw it out, and when it came back to the Commons, they decided to go with the House of Lords rather than going with the government. And the government's fingers were very much burnt over that. We're currently in the middle of a major controversy over more anti-terror legislation, where the government got a bill through the House of Commons on with a majority of 3 votes to reduce the time that terrorist suspects could be held without trial to 42 days. Hugely controversial. This bill is about to be defeated in the House of Lords, and the government is already talking about withdrawing it, perhaps in order to avoid defeat. So that's the kind of impact that the House of Lords is having. As a result, there's clear evidence that the government is consulting more with peers at the early stages of legislation. There are lots of meetings going on in the House of Lords between ministers and peers, including senior ministers from the Commons. But one of the interesting things that you get from this is that a more confident Lords, it's not a matter of Lords up, Commons down. The more confident Lords is actually strengthening Parliament as a whole. It's boosting the confidence of members of the House of Commons. I'm going to have to speed up. I wanted to say a little bit about competing legitimacies. Obviously, the House of Lords is appointed. You think that makes it illegitimate. But if you set the House of Lords against the House of Commons, you can see that the two chambers gain legitimacy from different places. The House of Commons is elected on a first-past-the-post basis for single-member districts. The House of Lords obviously appointed. The House of Commons is, this is a rather lazy term, a majoritarian system. The House of Lords is effectively a proportional chamber without being elected. And in fact, it's the House of Lords that is majoritarian, because the government in the House of Commons was elected on 35% of the vote, whereas the House of Lords represents more majority opinion outside the House in terms of party support. The Commons contains few independent members. The Lords contains a large number of independent members. The Commons is seen as being party dominated, whereas the Lords is seen as being expert. So the Lords has legitimacy problems. It's an appointed House. But in the current political climate, the House of Commons has some legitimacy problems too. Elected on 35% of the vote, seen as party dominated, that's not too popular. We're living in pretty anti-political times, and in a funny way, the House of Lords appeals to the public mood in a way that somehow the House of Commons doesn't. So they do have kind of competing legitimacy. Some things that came up yesterday. In the Australian context, I think there are some other assets that the House of Lords has which are worth mentioning. It does, of course, have long terms of office. Life membership is the ultimate long term of office, and this is beneficial to the way that it functions. People are able to be relatively independent of the parties once they're put in there. They're not reliant on the party anymore for patronage. It has continuous membership. It is continually being renewed. New people coming in, other people leaving, unfortunately in sad circumstances, given that it's life membership. The House is never dissolved. The House of Lords has not been dissolved since it was abolished by Oliver Cromwell in 1649. It has been continually in existence for 350 years, with its membership constantly being renewed. One of the things in both houses in Britain, which is of interest in the Australian context, I think, is that the speakers of both houses are completely independent of party. They are supported by completely independent non-partisan staff. The parties have no control over the administration of the House, really. And this is important to the way that debates are run, the way that people are called. The whips have no control over who is called in debates, etc. That's a very different cultural thing. Debate in the House of Lords is famously non-partisan. This can be exaggerated. I mean, it is a party house. The outcome of votes is largely predictable on the basis of party. But the presence of the large group of independent members is quite important, I think, in setting the tone for the House. members of the front benches on both sides don't feel that they can simply appeal to party in order to get people through the division lobbies. It has been said that the independent members sit like a jury in judgment of the arguments, and the arguments have to be sort of toned down and rational in order to appeal to the type of people who sit in the House of Lords, which is rather good for politics. The large size of the House, this might be a strange thing to say, but the large size of the House is actually an asset as well. It makes it harder to control, and one of the things that came up yesterday was how independents and small parties can have blackmail potential in the Australian Senate. Well, nobody has blackmail potential in the House of Lords because the balance of power is held by about 250 people. There's no Brian Harradine in the House of Lords. So what does the modern House of Lords tell us for bicameralism? I think it tells us some interesting things. There are some sort of lazy assumptions made about the way that modern bicameralism works, I think, which are rather exploded by looking at the House of Lords. The traditional dichotomies, elected versus unelected, legitimate versus illegitimate, doesn't entirely apply. The House of Lords shows that election isn't actually essential in order for a modern chamber to have legitimacy and therefore in order to wield influence. What it does demonstrate, which the Australian experience does too, is that party balance is very important to legitimacy and to influence. The House of Lords also shows that a veto power isn't essential to influence. There are many ways in which second chambers can wield influence through affecting public opinion, media debates, and even through influencing the votes of members of the other house, which does have an absolute veto. So, again, with the modern house, things may not be quite what they seem. I wanted to just say a few words about prospects for reform and the way that people view the current house. Obviously, the fact that the House of Lords isn't elected does leave it somewhat unstable, and there does continue to be pressure for reform, although, as Tony said, there's pressure for reform all over the world, even where chambers are elected, because they are essentially contested. The government is now finally, after around 10 years, has come round to the idea that maybe election is a good idea. But I think it remains pretty unlikely, and we could talk about why in questions if you want. What's interesting when you think about it is that although the current situation is unstable, if the House was elected, it would remain unstable. Because if it was elected, it would be elected on a PR basis, and Britain and Australia would come even closer together. But if we had a PR upper house and a majoritarian first-past-the-post lower house, what we would be into would be a constant debate about the competing legitimacy of those two different electoral systems. And while I get the impression that in Australia the lower house electoral system is seen as fairly legitimate, in Britain the House of Commons electoral system is already seen as being of questionable legitimacy. And set alongside an elected proportional House of Lords, I think that could come under serious pressure and perhaps even be changed. And then, of course, if you had two chambers elected by PR, they'd be essentially similar chambers and bicameralism would become rather pointless. So the system could actually be weakened by that reform. I used to be a strong supporter of election. I used to campaign for it, and now I'm having thoughts which make me unpopular with my former allies. I've come around to thinking that actually there are some principles which are more important than election. Election is important, but party balance is more important. I would sooner stick with a proportional appointed house than move to a majoritarian elected house. I might even exchange a house with all things being equal with long terms of office that was appointed versus short terms of office that was elected. I was talking about this with Bruce yesterday, and we were saying how, in any case, election by a closed party list, which is what we would probably have, it amounts to party appointment anyway, really. The party leaders decide who's going to be in there one way or the other, albeit with the veneer of legitimacy in a party list system. So maybe it's not so different one way or the other. There are further minor reforms which I think could be useful and perhaps even more desirable. I think I'll skip over those due to lack of time, and I really need to wind up. There is a problem in Britain with the fact that, going back to this old-new thing, The story of the House of Lords is a 1,000-year-old or more story, and it's a story about gradual piecemeal reform. Because there's been no decisive break with the past, apart from in 1649, the House of Lords continues to be seen as old. It continues to be seen as unreformed. Going back to the New Labour analogy, you had Old Labour and New Labour. There was a decisive split. It was when Tony Blair got rid of Clause 4. It may not have meant very much in real terms, but symbolically it was enormously important. The House of Lords has not had a Clause 4 moment. It has changed substantially, but there's no point that you can pin and say that's when it changed, it's a new house. And one of the problems that the house has in that is that it still looks the same in some respects. When you go to the BBC website or go to a newspaper website in Britain, look for an image of the House of Lords, this is what you get. This is, in fact, the House of Lords on one day per year for the Queen's speech. They're wearing their ermine robes. The rest of the year, it doesn't look like that. The rest of the year, it looks like this. This is the Speaker of the House of Lords, Baroness Hayman. This is the Labour front bench, the leader and chief whip. This is the Conservative front bench, leader and chief whip. The Liberals, unfortunately both men, letting the side down. This is the convener of the crossbench peers. You'll see we've got more women than men. People look pretty normal. It looks like a pretty normal parliamentary chamber. We also have a very high proportion, higher proportion than the House of Commons, of ethnic minority members. That's a former leader on the left-hand side, Baroness Amos. These are prominent members of the House of Lords. This is not the image that people have of the House of Lords, but actually this is a modern parliamentary chamber. So I'm just going to end on this point, that maybe the House of Lords needs a Clause 4 moment. Like New Labour, the creation of New Labour, it was a symbolic rather than a real change which made that difference. I think maybe scrapping the ermine in the House of Lords could have a bigger impact than many other seemingly more substantial things. And I do seriously go around saying that to anybody in high places that I can find. More seriously, though, one of the things that Tony Blair did in the making of New Labour was go to war with his former allies. And I think that the time when people may really realise that the House of Lords has changed is when it goes to war with its former allies. And it will do, because when the Conservatives get back into power, and current belief in Britain is that that may be fairly soon, although I'm not convinced, but it's quite likely now, the House of Lords will challenge the Conservatives in the same way as it has challenged Labour. I'll be able to stand up and say in the 10 years since David Cameron came to power, there have been 400 defeats in the House of Lords. That's the time when people will really realise that the House of Lords is new and not old. Thank you. Thank you.
There's only one file in there.
Thank you, Meg. That was very interesting.
And a bit too long. I'm sorry.
No, I think given we started a bit late, there was enough flexibility there. While we're dealing with the technological problems, they're always a problem for me, I'd like to introduce Dr. Ricardo Palizzo. This is the second time he's been down from the Griffith University to Canberra that I'm aware of this year. He came earlier in February to do a presentation when we had a seminar on committees, and today he's here to talk to us about bicameralism Italian style, which is a fascinating concept. Like Dr. Russell, he has numerous publications to his name, and interestingly enough, he has co-edited a number of documents for the World Bank this year. Dr. Palizzo.
I see you're happy that I'm not singing.
John wanted me to come down with the guitar, but probably next time. For today, we just stick to the Italian Parliament. My presentation is going to be phenomenally boring for a simple reason that it could be delivered, I believe, in 35 seconds, and then I will probably look at each other for the rest of the hour or the half an hour, because the Italian Senate and Italian bicameralism are not very interesting. And the reason was, I can put it in a formal way or more in a funnier one, is that the Italian Senate has always done whatever the lower chamber has done for basically 40 years, and nobody's ever bothered to study the Italian Senate, with the exception of Gianfranco Pasquino, who in 2002 wrote an article that was published in the Journal of Legislative Studies in a single issue devoted to bicameralism, where John and Mick Laver had their contributions, and Pasquino said, well, I'm trying to write this piece on the Italian Senate, but truly there's nothing to be said. And so basically, if I refer to that piece, you know, my presentation gets phenomenally short. So I try to add some more slides to make sure that, you know, I can give you something. The purpose of my presentation, I can leave without this. The purpose of my presentation is to say that actually the irrelevance of the Italian Senate has been greatly overstated by the Senate critics. And in fact, let me have a little digression here. In March, John Owens and I ran a seminar, a workshop, on the transformation of the balance of power between executive and legislative. And we said, well, we believe there's a variety of reasons why in some countries after 9/11, the executive has gained power and the legislative has lost power or has not exercised the oversight effectively. And John said, but what about bicameralism? And I said, John, bicameralism in Italy is like Shaquille O'Neal. And he said, like Shaquille O'Neal? And I said, yes, Shaquille O'Neal was asked by the press, you know, Shaq, you're not very good at shooting free throws. And he said, yeah, but I always make them when it matters. And I said, but when does it matter? When I make them. That's precisely the function of the Italian Senate. It doesn't do much, but whenever he does something, it is when it matters. So that's the bottom line of my presentation. Let's start here. Well, the three parts I'll give you. Okay, for 40 years, the Italian Senate has been, it will be a stretch to say it was a mysterious object of desire. Nobody desired much the Italian Senate, with the exception of the Constitution drafter, who wanted to have a bicameral system, not only because a bicameral system was the system we had in place before Mussolini took over in 1922 and graced us with 21 years of dictatorship, colonial wars, and a not entirely successful World War II, as you probably remember. And so they said, well, how do we prevent another Mussolini from arising? They said, well, we need to have a parliamentary form of government. We have to make sure that the parliament is dependent on the confidence of the parliament, and the parliament has to be bicameral. But more importantly, the Italian Constitution said, you know, but what's the key engine of our system? Well, it's political parties. And so they said, you know, they're going to run the whole thing. The problem was that the Italian Senate, pretty much like the Italian Chamber of Deputies, were elected with exactly, first of all, they both have roughly the same electoral system. It was a proportional representation system between 1948 until the electoral reform in 1993, and then from the 1994 elections onward, elections were held with a mixed member system. But the difference between the electoral system for the election of the Senate and the election for the House was that the election for the House had the quotas applied nationally, while in the Senate the quotas were applied regionally. The basic implication being that the magnitude of the electoral districts was very different. And that generated a fairly similar picture of preferences in the two houses, but not identical. And so from a representational point of view, most of the time did not make a difference. The Christian Democratic Party, which was Italy's largest party for 44 years, which had a majority of seats in the lower house, also had a majority of seats in the upper house. The Communist Party was Italy's second largest party, at the second largest contingent in both houses, and so forth and so on. But, as I was saying before, Italian Senate is like Shaquille O'Neal. Sometimes does something that actually matters. And the fact that Italian Senate was applying the same electoral law but with a different district magnitude implied that parties that were weak nationally but strong regionally could gain representation in the Senate. And that did not matter much until 1987 when the Northern League, the back then was not yet the Northern League but was only the Lombardy League, managed to capture this very strong Nordist, anti-Italian, anti-Southern sentiment and managed to get representation. And Bossi was elected to the Senate. So from a representational point of view, even before the 1993 electoral reform, the Italian Senate did make some little contributions to the Italian system of representation. This has become even more important in the wake of the reform because there has been major discrepancies in the electoral composition, the allocation of seats between the two chambers. And so it has happened that in the 14 years since the electoral reform has been enacted, the party or the coalition of parties which have been able to win a majority of seats in the lower chamber has not won a majority or a comfortable majority of seats in the upper house, and therefore, by not controlling a great majority of seats in the upper house, several governments, starting with Berlusconi I, Tuprodi II, and so forth, so on, have been shut down. And so you can say that in spite of the fact that this is supposed to be a completely irrelevant and useless second chamber, it has had a major role. But let's try to proceed in order. The political science literature, given this alleged irrelevance of the Senate, has never covered the Italian Senate at all, with the exception of the Pasquino piece to which I was referring before. But actually, if you look at Italian political science literature, you realize that between 1963, when Sartori published a book chapter in an edited volume on the Italian Parliament, the Italian Parliament was neglected almost entirely until the early 90s. And the reason was that Italian political scientists were looking at what were the true engines of Italian politics. So they were looking at the governments, government instability, government effectiveness or lack thereof. They were looking at the party system and at the political parties, voting behavior, and so forth and so on. But they were not looking at the parliament. And in a way, that's not entirely surprising. You know, we have heard today that the American system worked in work without parties. Madison was not thinking without parties. The Italian constitutional drafters had very clear in mind that the parties were the true engine of the Italian political system. And in fact, the Italian constitution, even before the Basic Law enacted in Germany in 1949, was the first constitution in Western Europe to say that actually parties are an instrument of permanent participation. They not simply contribute to the expression of suffrage at the elections, but also they basically perform a linkage function between society and the state on a permanent basis. So the consolidation of the Italian democracy and the functioning of the Italian political system was entirely based on Italian parties. And since we Italians are known for our generosity, we made sure to fill the parliament with at least seven parties all along. So a key issue was how do these parties manage to form a coalition, how do they manage to reach agreements, and so forth and so on. And that's the kind of questions Italian political scientists were addressing. Obviously, very little work was done on the parliament, and since the Senate was doing exactly the same things that the House was doing, there was no reason to waste time studying two chambers. You know, you could neglect both at once. But actually, so my first conclusion is, yes, it's true, Pasquini is right, the Senate was irrelevant, but it was not studied because of the fact it was irrelevant. The whole parliament was not studied. I skip a few things, but the bottom line here: Italian political scientists, looking at how the Italian bicameral arrangement, have used a variety of definitions. Some of them have defined this is in English. The version you have in print is in Italian. John told me, you know, not many people speak Italian here. It was an equal bicameralism in the sense that two chambers have exactly the same power. So the Italian Senate has as much influence as the Italian House of Deputies in appointing and firing the government, in passing legislation, in overseeing or scrutinizing government activities, as well as in confirming appointments. So they are equally in power. Anthony said that it is understood in Italian society and also in scholarly work that actually the lower chamber is slightly more powerful. That's true. On the other hand, Senate is perceived to be slightly more prestigious, among other things, for a simple reason. That if you look at the Italian Constitution very clearly states that whenever the President of the Republic is incapacitated to perform his function, the President of the Senate steps up. And so it's regarded as the second most important institutional figure in the Italian constitutional architecture. Also, being a smaller number, is believed to have or to be slightly more prestigious than the lower one, though that remains debatable. As far as the organization of the Senate is concerned, the Senate, like the House of Representatives, have 14 standing committees that basically correspond to the portfolios in government that is supposed to contribute to the effectiveness of the Italian government and enhance its ability to actually get legislation through the parliament. But I don't think there is any study that has actually praised the Italian government for its effectiveness. In reality, if you look at or you have only a superficial knowledge of the Italian political history, you probably remember the Italian governments are phenomenally unstable. No government has actually ever lasted for the whole length of a legislature. I think the single most durable government was the Berlusconi second, lasting for 1,400 days, so 400 days less than its whole constitutional term. And on average, the Italian government decides to suicide in less than 12 months. While the length of a legislature is of 5 years. But even in these respects, over the years, the stability of Italian legislatures has declined. So while the first five legislatures, so those elected in 48, 53, 58, and 63, managed to fulfill their whole constitutional terms, the following legislature were not able to do so. So we had not only government instability, government collapses, we create a new government, but we don't go to the election. But also we had greater legislative instability and more frequent elections. Given government instability and fragmentation of the party system, the Italian government had usually quite a bit of troubles to actually do its job. And so, constitutional lawyers, political scientists, institutional reformers have always said, what do we do with this Senate? It's entirely useless because if it does something, it does something that has already been done in the lower house, and it's basically detrimental to the functioning of our system because since they have equal powers, for example, to pass legislation, the same bill has to be passed with exactly the same wording in both houses, it's only going to slow down a decision that is going to be made in the lower chamber anyway, or otherwise, it doesn't add anything to it. So they thought, we have to abolish the Senate, or we have to change it in ways that are going to make it relevant. Bottom line is, some people say, well, a clear reform that would be very good is, first of all, to reduce the number of senators, because really, if the United States has 100 senators and it's such a big and powerful country, and we are such a small and phenomenally relevant country, why do we need to have three times as many senators? We don't need them, so let's get rid of them. And other people said, actually, we should go back to something that the constitutional lawyer Carlo Constamagna had advocated in the 30s. And remember, in the 30s, we had a very bold and bulky prime minister who was not known for his democratic credentials. But in those years, they were suggesting a Senate reform that would be along corporatist lines. So we have a lower chamber where voters cast their ballots for parties and candidates, and so we have the traditional representational linkage. And then we have a second chamber that represents along corporatist lines. So the Association of Lawyers as a representative, those of doctors as a representative, and so forth and so on. These proposals made in the 30s came back in 1997 when Massimo D'Alema, president of the bicameral committee that was in charge of drafting and modifying the Italian constitution, allowed parties to put in their legislative proposal for the reform, and the Italian social movement Tricolor Flame reintroduced these old corporatist ideas. Of equal brilliance was the proposal formulated by the Northern League, who was basically suggesting we need to get away from the current Senate. We have to do something. We have to create a Senate that looks like either the American Senate or the German Senate, which means a chamber in which the members are not elected by the voters, but are actually representative of the regional governments. And that's an important feature because, I didn't say that before, I was trying to mimic yesterday's performance by Michael Baum. The Italian Constitution in 1970 created a unitary form of state, a republic, a parliamentary form of government, two chambers, and regions. But regional governments did not become effective until 1970. And even after they were created in 1970, they were not at all functioning or functional or relevant in the political system until in the 90s, the president of the regions, our Italian-style governors, became directly elected. That's when the regions became truly powerful. And so at that point, when you have that delegation of power to the regions, direct election of regional governors, it becomes relevant or possibly meaningful to have a representative from regional governments in a upper house. And that's why this kind of electoral institutional reform was suggested. Well, in any event, I think that all my Italian colleagues were wrong. I mean, I think to say that the Italian Senate was such an incredibly irrelevant institution was not true. It has not been true lately. If we look at representations, I told you before, they were able to allow smaller parties to gain representations. But in legislative terms, the Senate is the place where all or the majority of the government bills are actually introduced, and more importantly, where a considerable number of government bills or bills that become law are actually either drafted or approved. As a peculiarity of the Italian Parliament is that after a bill is introduced on the floor and the Speaker sends a bill or a portion of a bill to the various committees, the bill can be referred to the committees in three different ways. One is the traditional referral way. Basically, we want the opinion of the committee, and then we bring the bill back on the floor where we take a vote and so forth and so on. But the Italian committees, both in the House and in the Senate, have the power, under specific circumstances, to either draft a bill, to draft a portion of a bill, or in other cases, to actually approve a bill. So, for example, if there's a minor foreign policy issue on the agenda, if one bill is passed on that topic in the House and then is assigned to the Senate doesn't find that topic to be of greater importance or believes that the committee could do a better job, the committee could actually take a vote in the community and make the bill become law without final vote of the whole assembly. And so basically, what my second bullet point tells you right there is that two bills were drafted in senatorial committees, but 350 were finally approved by the Senate or by senatorial committees. So basically 10% of the overall legislation in Italy had its final approval in a senatorial committee. And, well, I think that to me indicates that these committees are not as irrelevant as my glorious Italian colleagues seem to believe. Also, in addition to representing and lawmaking, we know the legislature perform an oversight function. The Italian Senate was not very active in this respect, also because in the Italian Senate, 40% of the senator never bothered to attend the meetings of the Senate because for a variety of reasons. But the good news is that in spite of the fact that the comparative literature has been telling us for years that there's a crisis of parliaments, the parliaments are becoming less effective and so forth and so on, which might be true if we only look, at least in the Italian case, at the parliament's overall legislative output, it is not true when it comes down to oversight. The number of oversight acts performed by the parliament has increased overall. The parliament's ability to keep the government to account has increased. And the Senate has outperformed the chamber. So on a variety of issues, where because of the fact that the government has tighter grip on the lower house fails to perform its oversight function in a remotely decent way, the Senate does step in and plays a key role. The oversight function in Italy does not require exclusively the parliament to actually scrutinize or control what the government is doing, but it also involves a second dimension, which is to provide government with some guidance. So let me give you a brief anecdote and then I go to the conclusions. A few months ago, I wrote a piece on executive-legislative relations in Italy in the wake of 9/11. And I said, well, in the Italian case, I don't see any evidence of an increase in executive power. And conversely, I don't see any evidence of a decrease in legislative power. And I think that this outcome is attributable to a variety of conditions, like it's bicameral, this coalition government, the government is not terribly cohesive, and so forth and so on. And John Owens told me, Ricardo, but what about bicameralism? And I said, well, I don't think it matters. But then I remember the Shaq O'Neill rule, which is it does when it does. And in fact, that was exactly the case. In 2006, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Massimo D'Alema, went into the Italian Senate and said, you know, we are not happy with the way in which the war in Iraq is going. I think it's terrible, and I think we need to pull out and we need to reconsider altogether the way in which we actually want to play our foreign policy in the next few years, because we don't think the Berlusconi government has done a great job, and so we need to revise that. And the Senate thought, we don't like it. And so they passed a resolution to actually force the ministry to modify its foreign policy line, which led the government to actually end in the resignation. That was not accepted by the President of the Republic, but almost led to another premature government breakdown that eventually happened 12 months down the line. So this is very important because it testifies to the major role and increasingly significant role of the Italian Senate. At least to me. Okay, fine. So, I'll wrap it up. And the bottom line here is the following. It's true that the Italian Senate does not play the same kind of role the Bundesrat is playing. It's true that that in many ways it is redundant because the representation that it provides is very similar to what is provided in the lower house. Nonetheless, jumping from that factually correct statement to the conclusion that the Italian Senate is a useless institution, it's wrong. And I think that a closer attention paid to the recent developments in terms of representation, oversight, and lawmaking in the Italian Senate will confirm my personal position, which is the correct one, that the Italian Senate is a very useful institutional component of Italian institutional arrangement, and it would be a great mistake to get rid of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we've come to that wonderful time where there's participation. Yes, a question already. Stan?
I thank you both, Ricardo and Meg. Very interesting presentations. My question would be now to Meg. You described how the changing composition of the House of Lords has given it a greater sense of legitimacy, and it has become a more active body as a result. If it were to be an elected body, then presumably that would enhance its legitimacy, and it would presumably become perhaps more active. Now, you were talking about the relations between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. I'd ask you to revert to the relations between the House of Lords and the government, and whether or not an elected House of Lords would probably be seen by a government as either a nuisance or a threat to the prompt enactment of its legislative program. And perhaps to put the same question differently, there are places, I'm told, where it's argued that an elected second chamber is fundamentally incompatible with the Westminster principles of responsible government. And I'd ask you to comment on how that issue is seen in London today.
You almost bring me on to the point that I glossed over about why I think an elected house is unlikely in practice. Because, yeah, I mean, you're quite right. The general assumption is that if the chamber became elected, it would become yet more confident and therefore yet more assertive. And there are those around, certainly in the media hasn't particularly noticed this, the public, I mean, the House of Lords is kind of fairly peripheral in the public's view of politics, which is a fairly kind of limited view anyway. But certainly in the eyes of politicians, government ministers know well, some of them painfully, that the House of Lords is being very assertive. And they know that if it becomes elected, it's quite likely that it will become more assertive still. And so although the government's position now is formally in favour of election, the governing party is entirely split on this question, and actually the opposition party is entirely split on it as well. And the Labour Party, of course, you know, like the Australian Labour Party, has traditionally been a kind of majoritarian unicameralist party, which doesn't like the idea of checks and balances. It wants to get hold of the levers of power and use them. So there is significant resistance to moving that way. So, I mean, there are two questions, you know, what would happen if it happened, and will it happen? And I think it's relatively unlikely to happen, so I don't focus too much on the other part of the question. But what I do say is what I said in the presentation, that I think there is a possibility of unintended consequences, that actually if we did get an elected House, and the way we would get it, actually, is if we have a hung parliament after the next election, and the Liberal Democrats, who are very much in favour of an elected House, partly on principle because they're a very, you know, they've always been a kind of pro-democracy party, but also it would suit them because it would put them in the balance of power in an even more powerful House. They might be able to negotiate it as part of a coalition deal or something. But if they did, as I said, I think the entire parliamentary system would probably be even more unstable than it is now. And perhaps this answers your point about is it incompatible with responsible government, because I think there would be pressure to move towards the kind of mainland European model of being a completely proportional system. I'm not sure the House of Commons majoritarian system could hold up under the pressure of an assertive elected House, which would push us towards being Italy. And I thought my point wonderfully, that you have an elected House, a co-equal House, and actually a House considered by most people to be fairly pointless.
Well, it's good for unemployment.
Hi, I'm Janet Hubert from Queens. Meg, can you say a little bit more about the appointment process? Because I wasn't entirely sure if ensuring the party balance is a matter of accident, or is it sort of the mechanisms that would ensure in future that there's party balance. And also, on your point that the government will sometimes negotiate with the House of Lords for amendments, you know, as evidence then that the House of Lords has more power than simply when it has a defeat. I know there have been times where the Commons has been quite upset, particularly on some of the anti-terrorist measures, that the government wouldn't respond to their concerns, particularly significant backbench number of concerns, yet would then negotiate with the Lords in the next round. Is it dangerous for the government to do this? Do they do it very often, sort of ignore similar issues in the Commons, just refuse to address their concerns, and then negotiate at the next stage with the Lords.
You people are being wonderful, because you're enabling me to talk about all the things that I would have put in a presentation that was longer, that would kind of on the cusp between being in and out. In terms of appointments, that's a really good question. In terms of are they party balanced and how is that ensured? We have developed a convention in Britain, which you haven't in Canada, that the Prime Minister appointing to the House of Lords does appoint not necessarily balance, but certainly not only from their own party. Margaret Thatcher famously appointed something like double the number of Conservative peers as Labour peers during her time as Prime Minister. So by no means balance. And that was pretty unjustified in those days because the hereditary peers were overwhelmingly Conservative. I think we're shifting towards a position where it is kind of balance. The Royal Commission that reported a few years ago said that appointments should be targeted at making it basically a proportional house, proportional to the way that people vote in general elections. And although that has not been formally implemented, it is essentially what the Prime Minister has been doing since. And a bit of the slide that I skipped about possible minor reforms was about giving more power to the Appointments Commission. And one of the obvious powers that you would give to the Appointments Commission, and this point has been made by a parliamentary committee of the House of Commons recently, amongst others, is that the Appointments Commission should be given the power of determining what the balance between the parties in new appointments is. Because one of the weaknesses of the system is that decision lies with the Prime Minister. It remains convention. He's only hemmed in by media and public opinion. It could be put on statute that appointments should be balanced according to general election votes. In terms of the government negotiating and the Commons getting upset, you're absolutely right. And that was something, again, I would have said had I had more time. On the anti-terror legislation, that occasion when I mentioned Robin Cook, the government had brought a measure to the House of Commons. It was an emergency measure. And there was a lot of concern on the Labour backbenches about it. And what the minister did was essentially stand up in the House of Commons and say, yes, well, we're hearing your concerns. We'll deal with them when we get to the House of Lords. Which made people so aggravated that actually a whole bunch of them voted against the government, but not enough of them to defeat the legislation. And it was defeated in the House of Lords. And that led people to reflect on whether it wasn't perhaps rather cowardly for the House of Commons to be letting the House of Lords do the difficult bits. And the next time a piece of anti-terror legislation came, which was very controversial, the House of Commons actually took its responsibility properly and it defeated the government. So in a funny way, as I'm saying, this more powerful House of Lords is giving the House of Commons more confidence to be assertive, because it knows if it doesn't defeat the government on the points of principle, the House of Lords will do it and the House of Lords will get the glory. If the government's going to be defeated, the House of Commons might as well stand up and do it. And it came very close on this 42 days legislation. I was very disappointed that the Commons didn't take its responsibilities and defeat the government. It left it to the House of Lords, but you know the outcome will be the same. The bill will not go through, and the House of Commons will be pleased.
Yes, the gentleman with the yellow taxi. Hello, my name is Yusaku Horiuchi. I'm also same as John. I'm from Crawford School at NU, and I have a question to Ricardo. I know, of course, you gave a presentation on bicameralism in Italy, but if you replace Italy with Japan, if you replace Italian with Japanese, if you replace Italian style to Japanese style, I think you can make a nice presentation on bicameralism in Japan. Because so many things are similar. We had a one-party dominant system for many years, and you had a major electoral reform in 1994, right? And we had a major electoral reform in 1994, and political scientists, the journalists, the media, and the commentators for many years were saying that the second chamber is irrelevant, useful, and political scientists in Italy or Japan have long time arguing that they didn't discuss. They just simply ignored the importance of the bicameralism. But after the electoral reform, you know, gradually we started talking about the role of the upper house. And given my understandings of the Japanese politics, I have one question, and I have my own answer to that question, and I would like to ask whether you agree with this. The puzzle, an important puzzle, is that Italian second, the Senate, compared to many other European countries, is more powerful, I think, in my understanding. For example, compared to Spain, of course, compared to UK, compared to Austria, and also compared to Ireland, maybe, because the two chambers are similar. They both have same powers. Same in Japan. The Japanese upper house is potentially so powerful. But for many years, in those two countries with powerful, institutionally powerful second chamber were ignored in the literature simply because there was a big, large party dominated the government for many years. But after the electoral reform, the party balance changed, and the majority party or party coalition in the lower house cannot have a large share of seats in the upper house, so a lot of things changed. So I always think that when we talk about strengths and roles of the second chamber, we always need to pay attention to the electoral systems. My opinion, and I...
Well, yeah. You could have given my presentation, actually, because I totally agree. I agree with that. I'm Duvergerian at heart, and Duverger famously said in his political parties in 51, but then translated into English in American in 1954. You know, you could understand European politics or politics in general if you ignore everything about the Constitution, but if you only knew about political parties. And, you know, I think it was a bit of an exaggeration, but I do believe that that's truly essential. I mean, you know, let me give you a different example. Last week I was, or 2 weeks ago, I was in this workshop talking about legislative performance, and I hear all these very learned and intelligent people talking about the formal powers the parliaments can have. And my wonder is, yeah, but have you ever thought for a second that these are not institutions that exist in a vacuum, but they're actually populated by political actors like political parties, and the fact that you have a certain kind of party system instead of a different kind of party system, the fact that you have, like in Italy, factional parties like in Japan, or you have unitary parties, those affect the way in which these institutions work. And so so I totally agree with your point, to make a long story short.
Dr. Russell would like to ask Ricardo a question.
Oh, but there was a gentleman
there
down there.
He was first.
Sorry, yes?
Oh. Ted Burke is my name. A British question. Has there been any informed debate in Britain to change or substitute the life peerage appointment with one of compulsory retirement age, as exists with judges very often?
You're true to form. You'll find that on one of the slides that I skipped over so quickly I didn't read the second half of it. That is another possible minor reform that we could pursue, and I think would be a very sensible one because, I've always been a little uneasy about a retirement age because people mature at different ages. Some people in the House of Lords go doolally in their 70s. Some of them are razor sharp in their 90s. But limited terms of office is what's more commonly discussed, putting people in for maybe a 15-year term or something, a long term. But and that would help keep a lid on the numbers, which risk going through the roof with constant appointments. Shall I ask Ricardo?
Yes.
This is kind of a question to Ricardo, but I think it's kind of a question to the whole room because it's a bit of a difficult question, I think. When we were talking about Indonesia yesterday, the presenter said that we have this chamber, but it doesn't have any blocking and amending powers, and therefore we've got two chambers, but we don't really have bicameralism. You said, I mean, admittedly, the chamber is powerful, etc., in theory, on paper, in Italy. You say that it's more useful than you think, because actually bills can go to Senate committees and be passed, etc. But what you seem to be talking about is two parallel chambers that are like two. It's like rather than having one chamber, you've got two, in the sense that you clone it so that you've got two places that can be producing legislation. And my question is that really bicameralism? Because, I mean, as Tony was talking about before, bicameralism is about competing representation, competing legitimacies, friction in the system. And what you seem to be talking about is a more effective legislative factory where you've got two places producing the output rather than just one.
No, I will never equate the Italian parliament to a sausage factory. besides, I mean, Anthony made a point, and I didn't want to repeat it as well, but, you know, for a bill to become a law, it has to be approved by both chambers.
Sure.
So it is a second house that provides scrutiny. For example, not to mention my work with John, but, you know, all the war on terror legislation that was passed by the Berlusconi 2 and 3 and the Prodi second government, whenever it was not adequately modified in one chamber, it was in the second one. And so, until the two chambers agreed on the final drafting of the bill was not approved. So it was a major way to actually correct some legislation that could have had a major impact on civil rights, civil liberties, and so forth and so on. And therefore, I think it will be absolutely incorrect to actually deny the Senate its ability to actually do things that sometimes the other house, for a variety of reasons, is either unable or unwilling to do. And the reason is that the composition of the two houses, as I was saying before, tends to be relatively similar, but it's not identical. Mm-hmm. You know, even now, after the 1993 reform that was launched by the April 1893 referendum that led to the enactment of the laws 276-93 and 277-93 for the election respectively of the House and the Senate. The Senate preserved create a system in which three-quarters of the seats are elected in single-member districts and the other quarter of the seats is allocated on a regional basis, on the basis of PR, and depending on whether parties are able to reach a 4% threshold. The House of Deputies instead applied a similar system but to national districts. So for the allocation of the proportional representation seats, parties that were relatively strong nationally but not particularly strong locally were better off in the House, and vice versa, parties that were strong locally but not nationally